Today is October the 18th, 2017. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is Hank Key, and my colleague is Joe King, and we are in the studio of PRN today. And PRN.fm also has the archive of this show that you can pick up if you're listening on podcast. Joe, what do we have this week? We have crack. What is crack? Is that the stuff that you smoke?
No. You got me confused, Hank, because crack is really a way of getting a drug by taking cocaine and cooking it with some other chemicals, and you get little crystals. You don't mean that, do you?
You mean it's not that?
We being the world at large, was amazed when we woke up the other day to find that crack, K-R-A-C-K.
Oh, it's not C-R-A-C-K. It's K-R-A-C-K.
That crack was bringing the whole world down on our ears, that we could no longer use Wi-Fi. We had to throw away the data part of our cell phones, that our routers were to be used as door stoppers. I think that the media overstated it by just a little bit.
Well, not really. Do you have any idea what that K-R-A-C-K stands for?
Not really. Key, re... I don't know. What does it stand for?
It's not good. Let's put it that way, okay?
It's a way of breaking into the security that we thought we had on our wireless routers. The WPA2, which replaced the previous security on wireless, was supposed to be foolproof. But according to the experts, there was actually 6 or 7 or 8 different faults within the WPA2 security form. And what crack did was it showed that just about every wireless router out in the marketplace was vulnerable to a hacker who knew what he was doing. Now, there was one very big proviso. The hacker had to be within Wi-Fi range of the router. So in order to run this, there were and still are a number of people who are at risk in more than one way. I've asked Michael Horowitz, who's used to be on this show and is still our webmaster, explained to me really the underlying problems and what there was there. And he also explained to me how mistaken the major media was in their reporting. I've asked him to take the email that he sent me with some very significant information and post it up on our website, pcradioshow.org, and you'll find there a list of all the routers that have already been patched or are about to be patched, the software that has already been patched. Incidentally, if you're running your Wi-Fi off Windows, Windows 7, 8, 8.1, and 10 have been patched. There have been some minor patches applied to Apple OS X, but not fully yet. They're working on the rest of it. At any rate, go to our website, pcradioshow.org, where Michael has posted the 2 or 3 lists that are really important for you to see.
Well, Joe, while you were speaking, CRACK, K-R-A-C-K, is an acronym for Key Reinstallation Attack, now, which probably means very little to most people.
I'm going to ask you, can you define that to me, or is it just alphabet soup?
It's alphabet soup. In other words, we in our culture, we like to come up with acronyms, and as you know, very often the acronyms has no relationship to the subject itself, like the Patriot Act.
Well, the Patriot Act is our abbreviations. there is no such thing as the Patriot Act. We're going to go in that one more time. It's the USA Patriot Act.
Oh, so there is something about patriotism in there.
No, nothing. It stands for nothing relating to patriotism. And as a matter of fact, some people would argue the reverse.
Well, the other thing that is important is that the Supreme Court is taking on a case that they will probably rule on, probably maybe early next year, and that's the fact that Microsoft, as you know, has their data center in Ireland, and the case is, can the government force Microsoft to turn over data that is stored in outside the country?
You mean, can they issue a warrant?
You know, actually, from what I understand has been happening, it's both. Issue a warrant as well as going seizing it, too, because they like, you know, the FISA court was like, that's a sham. I mean, that's supposed to be a court, right? When it's 100% one way.
What does FISA stand for? F-I-S-A. Foreign Intelligence something something. The point being that it's not that simple. Our Supreme Court can rule that material held in Ireland, in the server farms in Ireland, can be seized by warrant. A warrant can be issued to Microsoft for that data. But on the other hand, the law in Ireland adheres to the European Union privacy laws, and that warrant cannot be respected. So therefore, once the warrant is issued, automatically Microsoft is caught between a rock and a hard place.
How do you think it's going to? How do you think the court's going to rule?
I would have been able to tell you that a couple of years ago, but we have a new court now.
In other words, are they going to rule on something where it may not be enforceable?
It can be enforceable.
No, it's not enforceable if it's in another country.
It's enforceable because Microsoft is in this country.
Yeah, but if the data is in a different country.
The enforcement will not obtain the data. It will impact Microsoft. Microsoft's very wealthy. They got deep pockets. And this is a way that the government can rape it.
Okay. Listen, last week we were talking about cord cutting, and we really didn't go into much depth at all, and I think that we should. And
Let's start over again, Hank. What is cord cutting?
Well, cord cutting is really with a typical consumer right now in the home. They have cable TV service, they have internet service, and they have a telephone service, which may be part of the cable service. They call it three-play, and for the average consumer, if you count the cell phone, I was surprised. It ranges anywhere from $165 to $250 a month for those four services, and that's a lot of money. And people are saying, hey, it just keeps going up, and they're starting to cut back. And this other reason why there is so much cord cutting is that millennials are not really subscribing to cable TV because they don't go by a time schedule. They just go by things on demand. And in researching this, you know, if we were to say, okay, let's do some cord cutting, and the basic component in all this is you need the internet. I mean, you know, you want to cut the TV, but you're still getting the information off the internet. You want to cut your phone service, you go voice over IP, it's still over the internet. So how do you know what internet service is available? Now, I happen to live in Queens. And there is a URL that you should be familiar with, and it's broadbandnow.com. That's one word, broad, broadbandnow.com. And I was surprised because in my area, I figured, I have a Fios, I have a what's called Spectrum, used to be Time Warner. That was it. That's all I could come up with. And I find out that there were 27 internet providers, including three cable providers, six copper providers, six DSL providers, five fiber providers, one fixed wireless provider, four mobile broadband providers.
Wait a minute. That's what they said.
Now, in my case, I actually went to some of them, and I could verify, yeah, it is there. Now, I got to tell you, some of these providers may be for the – what you do is you enter your zip code, and for the zip code, it would say, like, in the case of I still call them Time Warner, okay, but it's Spectrum. They say 97% of the people can get it. In the case of Fios, it was a lot less than that. And the case of there was another service, 3%. So obviously these are small regional guys.
And they don't tell you on this broadband site where that percentage is.
But at least you know who they are. Give them a call.
Well, in Manhattan, they said 91% of the people have Fios available.
Well, just because you don't have it.
No. I, not only do I not have it, since Hank and I started having this argument, I've done a little bit of checking. And according to New York City, to say you have 91% of the area covered simply means you have the wire or the cable out in front of your building. And you may have it in your building or you may not, but that's up to your landlord.
Well, there's a problem, okay, is that some of the large housing units I know in Queens and also in the Bronx, RCN is in those locations. And if you want something other than RCN, it's not possible. So, and then when they, if you don't want to use RCN, use some other means of doing it, as far as they're concerned, you're part of the people able to receive it, and they call, you know, you have the coverage.
The whole thing is bizarre. You have no way of knowing. I called up Verizon, and I said, I just saw your ad on TV, and I'd like to get that Fios thing you got. And they said, what's your address, sir? And I gave it to them. And they said, oh, it's not available to you. And I said, but the ad didn't say it was limited. It just said I could get it.
Yeah, but the landlord has to allow it.
And I said, have you approached the landlord in this building? And she said, I wouldn't know that, sir.
Well, she's a clerk, okay, but...
So I approached my landlord. I approached my previous landlord. It's funny, Hank, since the first of this year, the building has been sold twice.
Wow.
Each time for a profit.
Oh, so did your rent go up?
No, they can't do that. I'm rent stabilized.
Oh, okay.
But I'll tell you what they have done. They took one-bedroom apartments, and I see they're being advertised as three-bedroom.
Well,
they're a lot smaller than they were.
Or the people haven't eaten in a long while, and they're a lot smaller.
How they're doing it, I don't know. Yeah. But that's besides the point. They said they had not been approached by Fios. They were approached.
That they're aware of.
That okay. They're aware of.
Okay.
They were approached by RCN, and they signed an agreement with RCN, so they now have... You have your choice of...
Oh, you have a choice.
Of Spectrum or RCN.
Oh, okay. Well, Joe, you know, when we talk about Internet service, there are things that you should be aware of. Just because they have it, you don't jump at it. You have to ask yourself a lot of questions. Like one of the questions that you probably want to ask is, what's the speed of the service itself? Because when I gave that website, Broadband Now, they list the advertised service, but they also give you, based on what information they have, the average up and download speed is for that zip code. And I tested some of the zip codes. In some cases, they're close. In some cases, they're like a fraction of what's advertised. So you got to be careful of that.
Indeed, you do. And then on top of that, you've got to be concerned with, if you're dealing with the Internet speed, are you also dealing with a similar speed in your cell phone? And what about your...
This is the thing about cell phones. Cell phone, the tower is different from a cable or... Fios, okay? It's different. It's a different source.
It is and it isn't, because if you get into it, for example, with Verizon, you can have them handle your landline, their TV, your wireless, your internet, and your cell phone. And while they're separate things, you've got to be concerned.
Now, the other thing that you have to ask, just because they have the services, what is the download speed and what is the upload speed? Is because if you happen to be one of the movie buffs, you like to see a movie a night, you want to make sure that you would contact people like Netflix or Hulu or you know, whoever's providing the movie and say, what bandwidth do I need to make sure that I don't get these frozen frames?
It's interesting because I've been getting frozen frames lately.
Well, frozen frames means you don't have the bandwidth. And so it's, you know, you freeze and it waits until it catches up.
Yes, but I haven't yet cut my cable.
Okay, but that's one of the things that you have to ask is not what is advertised, but you have to go to the source that's providing it, like Netflix. Okay, what should I look for so I don't complain to you?
If you take Hank seriously, what you would do is you would pick up the phone and call Netflix, and you would pick up the phone also and call whoever your cable provider is, and you would pick up the phone and call and that's what Hank would have you do. Now, I'm going to let you in on a little secret. You're wasting your time.
You're not wasting your time, but what you should also do is...
You would not get a straight answer.
Well, what you should also do is, if you happen to know someone who is an early adopter where, you know, someone in your building or next door to you that already has a service, talk to them, find out what is their experience on it. The other is go on the Internet, because when people find, you know, you find that the people that go on the Internet with reviews, they love to complain.
It's true. You'll get much more complaints than compliments.
Now, the other thing you also have to ask is, just don't jump at it, is what is the length of the contract and what is the termination expense if I want to, you know, like I know that I signed up with Fios, like it's a two-year term, but I also wanted to know, hey, if I want to cut out early and after a year, what is it? You know, I want to know.
What is it?
I would in my case, I would owe the balance. I would owe the balance, but so long as you know it ahead of time, okay? It's not like, you know, because some of these services they say, oh, you know, I get a postcard from Spectrum and say, hey, you know, for you know, we want you back, and here's how much we you know it's going to cost you, but you have to add to it any penalties I have to pay, you know. Of course, you know what I did. I called up Spectrum. Are you going to cover my penalty? The answer was no. Okay.
What penalty?
Early termination.
Oh, yes. That they wouldn't cover. But the nice thing is, that, at least for me, I don't know about Queens, but I was offered shortly after I signed up with RCN, I was offered by Spectrum a very nice deal, no contract, just a very nice deal. And I thought about it, and I said, no. If they had offered me that before I signed up with RCN, I would have taken it.
Now, the other thing that you have to do almost is, and this is just my rule of thumb, okay, is that you say, all right, what's the charge for Internet? And they'll tell you, and then you say, okay, now give me the full amount for regulatory access charge or the hidden charges. And don't be surprised if it ends up being 20% more tacked onto it.
Oh, at least 20%, Hank.
There is a public access charge. Now, you're going to say, what is a public access charge, right?
What is a public access charge?
It's for public television.
And how much do you watch public television?
Well, the thing is, in Queens, we negotiated separately from Manhattan neighborhood and Bronx and Brooklyn and Staten Island. They as a group of four boroughs, they negotiated together. We negotiated separately, and the reason is that we came up with a different kind of a deal, and I think we worked out well on it.
Well, Hank and I don't really agree on all of this, and I won't go into it. But one day I asked him what was public television, and he said, "Well, you have this thing called Manhattan Neighborhood," and I said, "I do."
You do. And
he said, I have four channels. And I said, I do. Now, I want you to know, I've lived in Manhattan for about 30-odd years. I've never watched any of those Manhattan Neighborhood.
Well, you have to understand that there are it's called PEG, okay? You have public, education, and government channels. So when you add them all up, it's about around 10, 12 channels. And you're paying for all 12 channels.
I'll tell you what else I'm paying.
Because there are four regular channels with each borough that's called public, okay? And the purpose of that is that the government says that you should be able to have a public soapbox and you should be free. Well, nothing is free. Someone has to pay the bill. And what they say is, okay, we will charge the cable companies or the service providers like, you know, Fios. And they said, okay, all we're going to do is just pass on the charges, and they can do it. And so every time you hear about, you know, I want this on public access and so on, someone has to pay the bill.
And Hank, you never, and nobody I know ever has heard anybody say, this has to be on public access, because nobody in New York City knows what public access is except for people involved in public access.
No, actually, you don't. You, I think you'd be surprised that there is a for those who are knowledgeable about that, that you can get public access. You know, there are certain kind of programs that you can get that you cannot get in the normal channels. All right, for instance. Local elections of a councilman, they're covered by public access.
I'll tell you something else nobody in New York knows.
They don't know who their councilman is.
That's right. And they don't care because they know one thing.
Now, wait a minute. You're supposed to care about your government.
You're supposed to care. I don't want to get into politics. The whole idea of this cord cutting, though, could make sense to some people. Hank points out that mainly, largely, the millennials look into it. I looked into it, and I found that I could save a considerable amount of money, except I know sure as shooting that as soon as enough people cut the cord, then the price of internet is going to go up accordingly. That's
well,
the way the market
well,
works.
Comcast already announced that.
Oh, did they?
Well, they. Well, we don't have Comcast in New York City, unless it was in a small area. But other parts of the country do have, and they're the largest one. And they're saying if you want internet only, $90 a month.
Which is like saying the rest of it is $10 a piece.
Yeah. Well, you know, I have to. I mentioned this on the air that when I went with Fios, I said, "Look, I want to keep this, down to a minimum on TV viewing." Okay, I don't need ESPN. I don't need HBO. I don't need Showtime. I don't need the movie channel. So, if I cut all that out, how much would I save? $10 a month. What? You mean all that? And if I wanted it, it was only $5-$10, and by the way, they also got gotchas too. By the way, now I know with Fios, we have high definition. Now that's the other thing you got to be careful of, right? So they came in originally, and I said, "Where's the high definition?" Oh, that comes with a second set-top box, not in the original. Wait a minute. You mean I got to get two set-top boxes to get high definition for one channel? Well,
they've changed that now, and I found something very interesting with the high definition. The other day, the TV went out completely, and they had to reset the set-top box, which they could do remotely. I discovered I could have done it simply by unplugging it and plugging it back in. It would automatically reset. And when it turned back on, I picked up the remote, and I forgot, frankly, what I was doing, because I wanted to see Channel 4, so I punched in 4, and it came back with no such channel.
Yeah, because it's supposed to be 3.
No. So then I found out that if I went to, I think it was 304, I would get it. So I went to 304, and 304 was not high def, 2, 3, 4, 5. Suddenly it was high def.
Yeah, you know, with people talk about, a 4K. They talk about high def. Now, 4K and high def are two different speeds, all right? When they talk about high definition, some people talk about 720. Some people talk about 1080. But 4K is really 1920 or somewhere in that range.
Wait a minute. 4K is supposed to be 4,000, 4K,
Yeah, but you got to remember, a linear measurement is different from square area measurement, okay? Just like when they talk about high definition, they're talking about, depending on who you talk to, 720 or 1080.
I thought 720 was low def. I've used 720.
No, no, less than 720 is low definition, all right?
Can I tell you something? They're driving me crazy with these numbers.
Well, now, I know that they're talking about, even higher definition. But the problem is that the cable companies are very slow to give you even high definition to begin with, because on a standard analog channel, they were able to get 8 regular TV channels or only 4 high definition channels. So they've been very slow to.
Well, all the primary broadcast channels, 2, 4, 7, 9, 11, 5, of them. They're all in high def, every one of them.
Well, the thing is, they were supposed to provide the public access channels with high definition, and they...
But that doesn't matter. Nobody watches it anyway.
No. You know, there are things on it that you probably wouldn't believe, okay?
You're right.
No, really.
I wouldn't believe it.
I live in Queens, all right? And in Queens, it's, as you know, the diversity of ethnic groups is very high, and you'll find that the public access, I know in Queens, we have a lot of foreign language channels, and people actually tune into those channels, Pakistanis, the Bangladesh people. To them, it's very meaningful to them.
I found out a number the other day. I'm sorry, it's very far off subject. But the second largest city of Albanian people after Tirana, Albania, is Astoria, Queens.
And the largest group of Jewish people outside of Israel is?
Probably New York.
In New York.
But it would include upstate and Brooklyn and different things.
No, it's actually New York is quite unique because most people refer to cities in a county. We have counties in a city. I mean, it's the other way around.
It is bizarre, but then it is pretty large.
Well, I want to cover one more thing. When you're talking about doing cord cutting, another way of getting that cost down is say, okay, I'm interested in it. Can I use my own modem? And if I can, what models can I use? That's another way of doing it. Actually bring the cost down, because you'd be surprised. You can save anywhere from $30 to $40 a month on that stuff.
I happen to have a deal with RCN, and that was part of going in. But I know with Time Warner originally, I had two different set-top boxes, and that one in my bedroom and one in the living room. And I had to pay for each of them separately. And that really annoyed me.
Well, that's why I found this website, broadbandnow.com. I would love to hear from listeners, they try and let's see what they get.
I'll tell you what else. Write this down. PCRADIO, that's PC Radio, at Google.com. PCRadio at Google.com. Write in and tell us your experiences with your cable, or if an extra thing, I'll give you a prize if you have Fios. Write in and tell us where the Fios is.
Well, okay, you can do that, but I was going to do something else.
What?
If they can tell us something that really we haven't been able to cover yet, give us a phone number. We'll call you while we're on the air to get you on the air to talk about it. Or if you have a real, I don't want it to be a... where you feel like you got to get back at a cable company, but you feel like, hey, there is something that's under the radar that people should know about. Okay, you know, you really want to do that. So I hope that they can go to it. And in future shows, or what we want to do, by the way, is to talk about the content itself. Now, we only talk about the delivery system, which is the internet. But if you were to how are people getting some of the information, like Hulu and the Disney Channel, ESPN, and so on? And what's happening is that these channels are offering separate costs. Now, you got to be careful, because by the time you add up all these pieces that you want, it may be more than the cable cost itself. Now, in my case, I only watch 2-3 channels or 4 channels, and that's all I watch. I love the Discovery Channel. I happen to like History Channel. I know you don't like History Channel because it tells you a different kind of history from what you're familiar with, you know?
I'm very old-fashioned. I like to read history books.
Oh. I tell you, the other thing I enjoy following is the Military Channel. It's a...
Well, there's the difference, Hank. I served in the Army. I served my country.
Yes. I salute you for your services.
I had all the military I need for the rest of my life.
Well, I tell you one thing that the military did you a disservice, okay? You know what that was?
What's that?
They gave you free cigarettes.
No, they didn't.
You had to buy it?
You had to buy them, 19 cents a pack.
Oh, are you kidding me? I thought it was, that's expensive. Because I was buying cigarettes from my father for $1.75 for a carton of 10 packs.
I don't know how far back that goes. I was in the military in the late 50s and the early 60s, and cigarettes did not go for $1.90 a carton. They went for $3 or $4 a carton.
Wait a minute. I'm talking about the 1940s.
Well, I don't know what it was in the 40s. Oh.
See, with you, then. I know what got you smoking, okay? 7 out of 10 doctors recommended, and you know what, right?
That's right.
If the doctor can recommend it, it's got to be good.
And if the doctor wanted something more for a treat instead of a treatment, you could smoke Old Gauls. And kind of advertising has disappeared. But the one thing that was different was in the Army, you didn't get anything free.
Okay, well, we have in our a second segment, the last half hour, I just want to tell you that Alfred Poor will be talking about clothes that changes the body temperature sensation. That's quite interesting.
That's interesting.
And robots with flexible muscles, and they'd use a 3D printer to do that.
Fascinating. It's a form of silicon, and they can actually 3D print it.
And vapor strip of medication?
That I don't understand. You'll have to listen to that one.
And then I asked Marty Winston, I said to him, you know, the automation of the house, how about all these plants that you have, you know, outside, inside, you know? And he came up with how he does it, okay? And then after, you're going to hear what I said to him after his presentation, I said to him, now how do I keep the animals from eating any of that stuff? Because, you know, the deers will eat some of the plants, and like a squirrels are eating my pears. Well, I got to get to them. You know what? Let's get to it. For the second half hour, we have a couple of very interesting segments. Dr. Alfred Poor will be talking about clothes that can change body temperature sensations. He will also be talking about robots with 3D printed flexible muscles. And he will also cover a vapor strip of medications. So you don't have all these separate pills to take. It just comes in one big strip that you can take in sequence.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearable technology from Health Tech Insider. Well, fall is here, and if you're like me, you're never the right temperature. Either it's too hot or too cold. And if you're in an office or someplace with other people, you can't go around changing the thermostat just to suit yourself. So what are you going to do? Well, you can do like they do in San Francisco and wear lots of layers and put on sweaters and take off vests and change your wardrobe throughout the day to accommodate the change in temperatures or how you feel. But before long, you may have another option available to you. Well, a few years ago, we wrote about a product called the Ember Wave, E-M-B-R, Wave. And it was created by a bunch of students at MIT. What it is a wrist-worn device that actually has a pad on it that can generate heat or cooling. And the neat thing about this is that you can choose whether to have it send out pulses of heat or pulses of cooling. And they've discovered that this is enough to trick your body into thinking that it's feeling warmer or colder. So it doesn't have to reheat your whole body, but it gives you the sensation of being warmer or cooler, and that can help a lot. The company is running a Kickstarter campaign right out of the blocks. It was looking for $100,000. They raised over $500,000, and they're planning to ship their first products in 2018. All it does is change your temperature. Doesn't tell time, doesn't count steps, doesn't do any of those things. So if you want to know what time it is, you're going to have to wear another device like a watch. This is a one-trick pony. Also, it's not going to help you out in extreme situations, such as make you feel cooler if you're exercising hard in a hot room. But on the other hand, the company says that they found that by regulating their sensation of how hot or cold they are, it can help them be less stressed, improve their mood, and improve their productivity. Some even find that it helps them fall asleep more easily. It's like having a little temperature regulator right on your wrist. It's called the Ember Wave, and again, it should be shipping next year in 2018. If you've watched movies or seen videos of robots, you've seen all kinds of pistons and rods and levers and gears and all kinds of devices that make the different pieces move. and they're very mechanical and create that sort of mechanical robotic motion. Researchers have been trying to develop soft muscles for robots, things that are more analogous to the actual muscle tissues in humans and other animals. The problem is how to activate those muscles, how to make them move. The typical procedure at this point is to use either hydraulics, pumping fluid into them, or pneumatics by pumping air into them. As it sounds, they require pumps, which can be bulky and typically are external devices that you have to hook up to them. So there's tubes running all over the place. They have to pump the water or air in and out to make the muscle work. Well, researchers at Columbia Engineering think they have a better solution. What they've done is they've come up with a silicon rubber matrix that they inject with tiny microbubbles containing ethanol, alcohol. What they've discovered is that by running electricity through this matrix, they're able to get it to expand or contract. And in fact, it is so good at contracting, it can be used to lift 1,000 times its own weight. So that's pretty powerful for the weight of the device. And again, it's 3D printed, which makes it very easy. So all you need going to it is a thin electrical wire running through it and a power source. It's going to be much simpler, and it's something that you could build into a more normal looking robot, or you could make a smart prosthetic limb out of it, an arm or a leg, for example. So this artificial soft muscle tissue can bend, it can twist, and could make it possible to create all sorts of new applications to augment and replace operations of the human body. I'm going to go out on a limb here and guess that you take prescription drugs. Now, it's a pretty safe bet because according to a survey by Consumer Reports, more than half the people in the U.S. take prescription drugs, at least one of them. And in fact, on average, they take 4 different medicines on a regular basis. Now, this poses many challenges. One, you have the challenge of keeping all your prescriptions filled. But also, it can be difficult for some patients to adhere to the prescription instructions for their different medications, which ones to take when and so forth, and the dosage and all that. Well, a group of researchers at the University of Michigan have come up with a system that could solve a lot of these problems. Basically, what they do is they print your medication. Now, they start with a small strip of soluble paper. This is paper that will dissolve in water. And then they use a technique that's used in lots of different industries. It's called vapor deposition. It's one of the mainstays in the display industry, for example. And what you do is you take a material and you heat it up until it turns into a vapor. And then the substrate, the soluble paper strip in this case, is cooled down so that when the vapor hits, a measurable amount of the material will deposit on the surface of that substrate on that paper. It's very similar to what happens when you have a cold pitcher of lemonade in the summertime. The water vapor in the air is hot, and then when it comes in contact with the cold pitcher, it turns into liquid and forms on the outside of the pitcher. Well, in this case, at room temperature, the materials are solid, so when the heated material, the vapor, hits the cool strip, it turns into a tiny layer of solid material. In fact, it creates microcrystals that are very soluble. They dissolve much more easily, faster to digest, faster acting. The other thing about this process is that you can print multiple drugs on a single strip. So you could end up with a personalized prescription strip that you would take one and it would be all the pills that you'd need to take for that time of day. The improved solubility of the drugs on the strip also could make many more drugs available. As it turns out, drug companies, one of the first tests that they run on a prospective drug is solubility. And when they put it in pill form, if it doesn't dissolve rapidly enough, then they discard it and don't bother testing it for efficacy or any other properties and just move on. Well, this vapor deposition creates a highly soluble form of the drug. And it could well be that this could make them soluble enough that it would be worth looking at some of the drugs that have been rejected, taking another look at them and seeing if it would be feasible to run additional trials on them and make them available. So this process has a lot of potential. It could be in the future when you go to the doctor and get a prescription They'll have a system right there that can print your drugs out for you on these little strips of paper. Also, if you combine this with standard roll-to-roll printing technology like they use in printing newspapers and such, it's possible that we could have a system that could print individualized doses of many different drugs very rapidly for thousands of patients at a time, which could drive the cost of medications way down. So this is a process that's still in the labs, but has great potential for changing how we take prescription drugs in the future. For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. We need a law so enable people to take revenge on people who have hacked their systems. Two members of the U.S. House of Representatives introduced a law bill that would allow hacking victims to seek revenge and hack the hackers who hacked them. The bill is called ACDC, the Active Cyber Defense Certainty Act. It amends the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act to make limited retaliatory strikes against cyber hackers who have hacked your system legal in America for the first time. The bill would allow hacked organizations to venture outside their networks to identify the intruder and infiltrate their system and destroy any data that has been stolen and deploy beaconing technology to trace the physical location of the attacker. While it doesn't solve every problem, ACDC brings some light into the dark places where cyber criminals operate. The certainty the bill provides will empower individuals and companies to use new defenses against cyber criminals. You think it's going to work? Well, I don't know. For the one who wants to use this defense, they have to prove first that they had been injured. I don't know how this is going to work out, but I happen to agree with it. There ought to be a law. Yes, indeed. We need a law so enable people to take revenge on people who have hacked their systems. Marty Winston, I've asked him, in this automated house, how do you water the lawn? How do you water the plants? And he's talking about a big word that I can't even pronounce.
One thing we look for in developing the automation for our 40-year house project, 40yearhouse.com, is getting more sensor information. Because the more information we have, the more we can skip guessing. We can deal with actual measurements. If we skip guessing, we have the ability to build closed-loop systems, meaning if you know a value going in and you apply changes, you don't have to guess at how much change to introduce. You measure the result of the change, and it tells you what you've done. Now, I'm going to introduce you to a word you've almost certainly never heard. Is this fun? Evapotranspiration. Evapotranspiration. Just, you know, it just dances with the tongue. It ought to be a song, you know. Evapotranspiration. No, never mind. Sorry about that. Evapotranspiration refers to moisture that evaporates from plants and soil in combination with the moisture that plants are metaphorically perspiring. They lose to the atmosphere. So it's a drying out. Evapotranspiration is natural drying out of soil and plants. And evapotranspiration plays into not having to replace plants, not letting them die, keeping them healthier in landscape care approaches that I learned about from SkyDrop. SkyDrop is a company that makes, and it's called SkyDrop, a wonderful irrigation controller for your home, up to 16 watering zones with SkyDrop. It goes onto the cloud, the one that means a server at somebody else's place, to determine the really complex calculation behind evapotranspiration. Here's how evapotranspiration works. I'll simplify. You let the plants in the soil dry out to just short of their stress levels. And then you give them all the water they can tolerate. Not enough to drown them. All the water they can healthily tolerate. And then you let it start drying out again. Now what happens is Having been dry, the root will naturally head deeper to try to seek out water. If you keep watering it every day, it's going to go out shallow because that'll be all the water it needs. If you let it get dry, it starts to go deeper to find more water. Deep, healthy roots are key to the health of the plant. That's really, really important. And it also builds in some drought tolerance. Now, for grass, for example, in a drought, the leaves, the blades of grass, might start browning or yellowing, but the plant itself is healthy, and when water returns, that plant will again turn green. Evapotranspiration as a basis, that this let it get dry and don't let it die, hit it with a lot of water just before stress sets in, and then stop watering. This is what SkyDrop is doing with their algorithm. They pull in data from stations that are fairly local to you and use that data to help figure evaporation through heat, through relative humidity, through other factors. And that's kind of cool. And then when it's time to apply water, they kind of figure out how long to turn on the sprinkling system. But I want to point something out. That's an open-loop approach. It's estimating. It's guesswork. And make no mistake, SkyDrop's the best thing you can buy out there for your house right now in terms of the health of your lawn and your planting. It's a great choice. But I don't believe in stopping with a great choice if I think there's a way to make it better. And almost everywhere that we look at this stuff, going from open loop to closed loop helps. In a closed loop system, you start with a soil moisture measurement. And that's tough to do. There are, my landscape designer tells me, there are no consistently reliable ways to take soil moisture measurements. Have an answer for that in a minute. You start with the soil moisture measurement to determine when it's dry enough. Yeah, you still check local weather, but weather that is very local. We'll have a weather station on site keeping track of those factors, the heat, the humidity, the airspeed, UV exposure, all of that stuff. We also have API access to the National Weather Services with data down to single address granularity, so we can get specific readings, but also get some forecast data on what's coming our way. Those bits of accurate information up front are a very good start to not guessing wrong. You know, you're bringing the plants to just before stress level before you're turning the water on. What if you're off a little bit? Are you at stress level? Are you killing the plant? That would be a bad outcome. So by having a direct read of the real variables up front, you kind of improve the odds of that. On the back end, again, you put water in until it really can't handle any more water, which I'm sure the landscaper will tell us for each plant and soil combination in the watering zones. But again, you want to try to read the moisture level. And for that matter, you really want to add a flow meter so your sensors can tell you how much water you've actually put into the soil. There is no metering of soil with the other systems other than to guess at it through the timers. We don't know how effective that is. And I might add, regardless of what's in their algorithms, I'm going to pause that watering if the wind is blowing so fast that it's all blowing off in the mist. We'll still get everything to happen soon enough. Soon enough. We'll let a little spray happen, but we will be back after it's all blowing away to a point where it's all being put to good use. Now, I promised to talk about how you measure moisture in the soil accurately, and I had a nice email from a pal who's with IEEE, and he told me that of all the measures that he's encountered for doing that, the one that seems to work the best is the one that the satellites are using. They bounce radar off the ground, and they use ground reflectivity of radar as a very accurate proportional measure of how much moisture the ground is retaining. Well, I heard that, and I couldn't help but think about the fairly inexpensive $10 to $20 Doppler radar heads that I'm able to locate for other purposes in the build. And if I can make that work, I'll be prototyping to see if I can. If I can make that work from a couple of feet above the ground in each of the watering zones, I have closed loop measurements. I know from that, with some degree of accuracy, may not be total, but with some degree of accuracy, how dry it got, how wet it gets. And based on closed loop control, We're no longer depending on guesswork. So where do we start? We started with the idea that a lawn and plantings cost too much to replace to want to have to replace them. That standard ways of watering with those timer things running the solenoids are luck as much as anything else. Even worse if you're waiting to pull the hose out and with that sprinkler head spinning on it. That Rachio, which does some weather forecast integration with a Wi-Fi controller, was a good first step. That SkyDrop, with the incorporation of an algorithm that takes an evapotranspiration approach to watering, is the best there is right now. But that going to closed loop by improving monitoring makes it even better. Improving the monitoring by closing the loop. So in lighting in the house, you set a dimmer. Are you taking a brightness measurement? A brightness measurement with a dimmer puts the dimmer where you really want it, not just where that amount of juice is sending it at the moment. Is there a difference? Yes. The difference is ambient light. And by taking ambient light in combination with the room lighting, you close the loop, and you're running less power to get the desired amount of light in the room. Closing the loop. Open loop control systems, closed loop control systems. And now that we're done looping the loop, I think it's time to back up, back up, back up. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you very much, but you knew I was going to throw another challenge at you. Now that you have healthy plants, how do you keep those animals away from biting or eating any part of the plants? You knew I'd get you on that. Public service announcements. Princeton PC Users Group will have a meeting Tuesday, October the 24th, 7 p.m. Topic of presentation is passwords, passwords, and more passwords. Meeting will be held at the Mercer County Library in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. The Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation on the Bundle Hyper-V Virtual Machine Program in Windows 8, 8.1, and 10. Thursday, October the 26th, 6:45 p.m., they'll meet at the Middletown Library Lodge Meeting Room at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. Westchester PC Users Group will have a presentation on cybersecurity. Thursday, November the 2nd, 7 p.m., they'll meet at the Keller Williams Realty, 120 Bloomingdale Road, first floor, in White Plains, New York. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will have a meeting on Friday, November the 3rd, 8 p.m., Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. Danbury Area Computer Society will have a presentation on 3D design and printing Tuesday, November the 7th, 7:30 p.m., at the Danbury Hospital Auditorium in Danbury, Connecticut. New York Amateur Computer Club will have their main meeting on Thursday, November the 9th, 7 p.m. at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building, Room 401, Manhattan, New York. Long Island Macintosh Users Group will be meeting on Friday, November the 10th, 7 p.m. at the New York Institute of Technology, Old Westbury Campus, Northern Boulevard and Valentine's Lane, Auditorium of the Harry J. Shore Hall. The Computer Learning Center at Ewing will have a presentation on new tech toys, December the 5th, which is a Tuesday, at 1:30 p.m., Community Room 999, Lower Ferry Road in Ewing, New Jersey. And all these meetings are open to the public. There's no charge to attend these meetings, and we hope to see you there. And for other club meetings that I might have missed, just let me know at hank@pcradioshow.org and let me know where the meeting is going to be held, what time, what date, and what the topic may be. The website for the Personal Computer Show is www.pcradioshow.org, and we communicate via Twitter at PCRadio212. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM on the Internet and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM, 99.5 New York on the radio. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing and back up, back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key. On behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and keep cool until we meet again. Same time, same station next week.